Welcome to Relatable. This is your host, Teresa Freeman. We're diving deep into the dynamic world of communications, crisis response, public relations, and journalism. Our guest today is Julie Parker, President and CEO of Julie Parker Communications. She's not just any communication expert. She's been on the front lines managing public relations and crisis communication, primarily serving police and government. She has experienced firsthand the fast-paced life of 24/7 news after a long and tenured career with broadcast journalism. She discusses how that helped her business to be successful now. Stay tuned as we explore the art of storytelling as a means to create cultural change, how to handle rejection, and valuable insights on influencing others that include results and pivotal moments that require you to trust your gut. All right, are you ready?
I'm ready.
You're ready?
I'm ready.
Is it strange for you to be on the other side? Because, you know, you've been an interviewer most of your life. Now you do a lot of coaching and training. So now you're in that seat.
It's always challenging because I want to nail the sound bites because I teach people to try and nail the sound bites. So there's a lot of pressure.
I know. It's exciting. I appreciate you being here.
Happy to.
I think that we have a lot of cool things to talk about. One, you have a really cool job and you've had a really neat career. So I think from the perspective of one of the things I love to do is have people on that we haven't talked about yet in terms of career path and what they've done. So you're my first previous reporter on sort of business owner.
Yeah.
So I want to talk to you obviously about that path, but then I think also you do a lot of coaching and teaching. And so maybe we could talk a bit about that too, in terms of advice that you could give in this space that you've become an expert. So I feel like I could talk to you about both those things.
Where do you want to start?
Tell me what a current day in the life is like right now.
Oh my goodness, I'm tired.
You just told me. Tell
So this is this week.
Yes, tell me.
Drive up from North Carolina, Wilmington, my new home, which is right at the beach. Yeah. Amazing. Drive to Ocean City for basically a reunion because I started my law enforcement media relations career at the Prince George's County Police Department right outside Washington, D.C., and there was a Maryland Chiefs of Police, Maryland Sheriffs Association conference, and I did a presentation for them on crisis communications. Walking into a big old ballroom and knowing a decent amount of people in that room is really fun. And it was also pretty powerful because that's where it all began. Yeah. There's a news career before my first police department. I also worked at Fairfax County PD. Yeah. But that law enforcement piece is what launched this career that I now have, running a communications firm that is largely focused on law enforcement, media relations, public relations, and then crisis response.
I think that's fantastic. And so at any time you can be in front of a room, like we call it on the podium, but you also have clients where you're doing a lot of coaching and training in terms of them being in front of the camera, right? Because they're in crisis response or they have to be on a lot to work with the community and let them know what's happening.
Our business is cut into three pieces.
Okay.
There's the crisis response. So think of, but not as glamorous as, Olivia Pope and Scandal.
Okay.
It's that kind of concept, but it's not. I don't have the white coat and I don't drink as much wine as she did and I'm jealous. So there's the crisis response, something bad has happened to an organization, and we get called in the aftermath to assist with all of it. Do you do a news conference? If you do so, what do you say? Who's speaking? Handling the social media strategy involving whatever that crisis was all about, and helping them get shored up and work on the reputation and trying to build it back, which in many cases is needed, because there are two kinds of crises. There's the thing that goes boom. Mm-hmm. In Pennsylvania, the guy gets captured for 14 days. They're searching for him. There's that really obvious crisis. But then there's a reputational crisis, which is the behind the scenes, in theory, at least initially, where something has happened that could harm your reputation that may or may not be in the public eye. So we help organizations with all of that. That's part of the business. Mm-hmm. Another part of the business is traveling across the country, doing all sorts of training, public speaking training, crisis communications training, preparedness, trying to get ready to, when that crisis hits, you're prepared to deal with the public and with the media. And then the other third is we have clients on retainer, public relations, coaching, social media contracts where we run their social media platforms.
Yeah. And we're one of your clients.
Yes, ma'am. And we love when we have clients where it becomes not just a business relationship, but like a friendship.
Yes, for sure. And we have, it's interesting just hearing you speak, and I don't know that we've ever talked about this. You and I obviously have a lot of intersecting interests in terms of how people communicate, how do they effectively put the best version of themselves out into the world. And my career prior to starting my own business is I was responsible for our risk function from a talent perspective at Deloitte. So any type of crisis, I was involved in managing exactly what you talked about. So in terms of the reputational risk, I mean, we had a lot of people that would come to the table in that size of an organization to talk about the comms piece, the people piece, the tech piece, like what are the all the different levers that need to be pulled. But what I, one thing that you said that I think just so we have this moment, as an organization, the preparedness piece and hiring you to get some training in advance is such a great idea, because when the time comes and you really need it, you'll have had a little bit of a ramp up. You still, when the thing hits, things are going to be volatile and fluid, and you'll have to react in the moment for sure. So that real time help. But having some exposure and that preparedness, particularly, I would think, I'm interested in if you agree, particularly on how people collaborate within your organization to handle it. So the better synergy you have and you know who's on first and you know what people are doing, then when it happens, you're ready.
One of my favorite examples of why crisis communications training matters is we have a city government that is on retainer. And mm-hmm. as part of that, we came in and did a 2-day crisis communications training event where the city brought in the PD, fire, emergency management, the mayor, key stakeholders in this city government. And we did a customized tragedy, basically, for mock.
Yes. Yeah. And, simulation, right?
Yes. And had them go through the motions. So and what they figured out as a result of this real feeling exercise is that they completely forgot that they had an emergency manager. She was a new position. She'd been there for 3 months. They're going through all the paces of this exercise. She raises her hand like 1 or 2 hours in and says, "You all forgot me." And you wouldn't know that unless you practice in advance. Yeah. If the crisis hits and you forget about a key player in your organization, that's a problem. So doing these exercises actually does yield multiple benefits.
And I will say, because we did them a lot, the other thing it services, which is I think maybe an unintended benefit, is that you start to communicate better as a team when you're not in crisis. So just the idea of, okay, we were brought together for this reason to practice crisis response, which makes sense. Now you start to get to that point of this one being, I'm still here or I'm new here. Now you're building relationships. You're building continuity. You have a way to now that if something comes up that's not hotbed, but it's just a normal working matter, you have better communication. You're better connected. I think there's so many benefits to doing it.
It matters so much. And I've heard that phrase, relationships matter, ever since I joined my first police department.
Yeah,
it is so true. If nothing else, if you just get people in the room who don't normally sit in a room together and say, "Hey, here's a crisis, do what you do, talk amongst yourselves," it's amazing what you uncover as a result of just an exercise.
What do you love about working with this population of people? Because you have such a niche group of people that you're working with in terms of that segment of your business. So tell me what it is. I mean, I bet there's a lot of emotion there and fulfillment.
I would say about 80% of our business at any given time is law enforcement. And that just happened organically because I started at a police department, then I moved to another police department. I've been a guest lecturer at the FBI National Academy for a decade. I've worked for the International Association of Chiefs of Police. I work for the Naval Postgraduate School's Center for Homeland Defense and Security. And all of those different pieces, meeting these leaders and seeing what they do and the amount of time they devote These are public servants through and through. There is no such thing as a 40-hour work week. That's hilarious.
Right.
And so I've seen the missed family events, the, you know, the homicide detectives working 48 hours straight, the police chief with the angst on his and her face as they deal with a crisis. And yes, there's you see bad news out there about police departments, especially in the last, I'd say, decade or so. You don't see the same sort of look inside a hospital, for example, where we all know there are mistakes being made.
Yeah.
And this profession is very much in the public spotlight. And I feel very driven and very passionate about trying to help them be, as a profession, communicate better, because it matters so much, as you know. And the profession has come a long, long way from even a decade ago, where, you know, back in the day, law enforcement kept everything close to the vest. We're not in a place where we can do that any longer. And you've got agencies who are incredibly transparent, which means other agencies are going to be held to that standard. And we really are passionate about helping the profession become better at that.
I love that. Tell me a little bit about your path. So you spent a lot of time, you used to live in the DC area, right?
Yeah, long time. Yeah.
So tell me about your news career before you moved into this part of your journey.
I'm a Terp. I went to the University of Maryland and graduated with a degree in broadcast journalism. At that time, in the 90s, you were supposed to go anywhere in the country and start at an itty-bitty TV market. And I just didn't want to. I wanted to stay in the DC area. I did not want to go to a teeny tiny town. And so I wound up first at C-SPAN. I spent 4 years at C-SPAN, which turned out to be a great foundation for journalism, because we were very focused on both sides. We were going to be fair, and we're going to tell both sides of any story. Then I went to News Channel 8, which is now no longer, but it was a 24-hour cable station, and started my on-air. Oh, I forgot a step. I was in Hagerstown, Maryland for 10 months as one of those one-man band multimedia journalists. So I carried the gigantic TV camera back in the day on my shoulder, anchor, reporter, writer, editor, custodian, like every job. Did that for 10 months. Then went to News Channel 8 for 4 years. I was on the anchor desk right after the second plane hit the World Trade Center. Had been downtown in DC covering Michael Jordan as the owner of the Washington Wizards. I remember driving past the Pentagon on that September day, looking at the Pentagon, looking at the gorgeous blue sky, driving to Springfield, walked into the newsroom, saw that happen. And in a matter of minutes on the anchor desk as a part of history, like, it's crazy what you get to do as a journalist, how you're describing what, you know, becomes history.
Yeah.
And spent 4 years there. And then there was a merger. Channel 7 gobbled up News Channel 8. And I spent 9 years as a general assignment reporter, substitute anchor. I started a talk radio show on 106.7 The Fan, Parker and Parker, with a non-affiliated Parker. We weren't married or anything. Alex Parker, sports journalist. Then that became a spinoff to a TV show, Parker and Parker. So really exciting, full journalism career. And then I got drawn into the world of law enforcement media relations in 2011. It was pretty new at the time to have a former journalist take over in that position. And I'll tell you, I went into that police department like, we're going to tweet about our homicides. We're going to do this, that, and the other. And they looked at me like, no, slow down. But we got there, and we sort of changed the way that department communicated.
One of the things that I talk about a lot and that I've worked with a lot of people on is this idea of a second act or career transition. And it's interesting, as I've gotten to know you and some of your team, and we've talked a lot about this, the idea of people that have a career in journalism, particularly broadcast journalism, there's a shelf life there. And your skill set is fairly specific to a unique industry. And I, you know, one of the things that I think I help people do is try to translate that skill set, because I do think there's a lot that translates to other industries and other areas where you've obviously found this really cool segment. And so it's help of that education of, you know, here's what you did in this space, but it translates and you can do these things in another space that actually, you know, add value in a different way for you. And as someone who was able to make that jump and transition and do something that one sounds like you're passionate about, you're good at, that you hit the ground running, what counsel do you have for people in that profession in terms of being a broadcast journalist? And at what point should you start thinking about it? You know, if because of that and that shelf life, I imagine sometimes you have control over about and sometimes you don't.
The profession of journalism
yes.
has changed so drastically. When I was a reporter, you just thought you're going to be a reporter till the end.
Yeah.
That's it.
Lifer.
You're in DC. You've made it. You're done. Well, that has changed dramatically. And it's interesting you asked this question. I was looking at a Facebook post. There's a group of TV news people who are either on the edge of or have just left journalism and now are in the next phase. And there was a woman posting saying she's got to get out, that it's bad. It's bad for your mental health. It's so stressful. There's so much that's put on them now, more and more than ever, because of social media. They have so many responsibilities, so many stories to hit, fewer journalists to do it. And she's like, I have nothing else. I have no other skills. And it was heartwarming to see all of the either current or former journalists saying, you have so many skills that you don't even know. And that's important for people wherever they were to think about, how does this translate? So as a journalist, you are deadline driven. You have got to get on the air when you're told to be on the air. How many people do you know that you've worked with, that you've coached, who can't make a deadline? If you could find someone whose number one skill set is, I will hit that deadline come hell or high water, that's a very valuable skill set. And to be able to stand up and to present to a room and command a room, that you, not everyone can do that. That's a really hard thing to master. So think about or get in a conversation with someone who's not in your profession and talk through, what do you think that I can do? Because sometimes you can't see your strengths, like you're in it and you don't even know the skills that you have.
Absolutely. And I think what's so interesting too, from my perspective, now that I've dipped my toe in and I've been able to meet more people, the idea of the obviously on the communication side, being able to articulate things, being able to hit that deadline, I think thinking on your feet and that pace. So the pace that you're used to in that environment, I think a lot of organizations can benefit from someone that's used to that pace and making quick decisions and being real time in the way that you have to adjust to things. Like those are also skills that I think are so beneficial in the corporate space that maybe get overlooked or people aren't talking about.
Nothing will make a journalist or a former journalist or a PR person crazier than slow.
We joke about this.
Let's have a meeting about the meeting to have a meeting and then follow up in an email about the meeting. Oh my gosh, make a decision.
Right.
And that's what I love about my current career is that you have got to move fast. Crisis, by definition, should mean you need to move quickly and decisively. And when you see organizations stumble over themselves and you don't see them come out as the crisis is unfolding, you can almost picture them all sitting around a table, all meeting with the lawyer saying, say nothing.
Right.
No offense, lawyers.
Yeah.
Nothing, say nothing, say nothing. And you just don't have time in a crisis. Social media has changed that forever. You have got to move quickly, and journalists are wired that way.
Yeah, for sure. And I think as you're talking, maybe it would be helpful to understand from your viewpoint and the clients that you have, what are some of the common mistakes that organizations make, whether they're in the preparedness cycle or even in the thick of it and handling a crisis?
Well, one, it's to overlook the preparedness piece.
Yeah.
It's to think, we're good. We have good people. We'll be fine.
We'll figure it out.
We'll figure it out.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, you may be able to, but what is that process going to be like? And how long is it going to take you to get where you need to be and face the public? How stressful will that process be if you've never gone through the steps and it's brand new? As the crisis hits, it's going to be messy. A common mistake is waiting too long to call for backup.
Mm-hmm.
It's okay if you don't know how to manage a crisis from a public standpoint, know that ideally in advance, identify someone who will be your backup. If you don't have them on retainer, totally get that. Resources come into play. At least do your research in advance. If and when the time comes, we're going to call upon this firm to help us because for whatever reason, we know that we're not going to be able to handle that. We don't have enough staff. We don't have the kind of staff who's trained to do that. We're going to be overwhelmed. Too often, organizations wait too long to call for help. And the longer your crisis sits and unfolds and drips out in terms of information slowly coming out, you're just extending the life of your crisis. Mm-hmm. You're extending the news cycle. You're extending the social media cycle. And the longer people wait to hear from you, the more misinformation gets out there and the more people will decide you are guilty. That's why you're quiet.
Realatable is sponsored by TFA Soft Skills, your one-stop shop for workshops, coaching, speaking, and soft skills development. If you'd like to hire Teresa, visit www.tfasoftskills.com for more information.
Yeah, it's interesting. It's like the controlling the narrative. Like
you're trying to.
Right.
Shaping.
Mm-hmm. For sure. That makes a lot of sense. And then in your industry that you focus on, what are some of the things? So obviously there's the reputation of individuals that maybe get caught on camera, I imagine, or there's something that happens that's distorted or interpreted incorrectly in terms of something that happens. Are there other common themes in your industry or that you see? Or is it so it's hard to pin that down just because each community you work with, you said you're national in the way that you work. So depending on the community, the people, it's kind of anybody's game in terms of the type of crisis.
I will say there's one unifying theme, no matter where you are in the country, no matter what your organization is and how bad your crisis is, don't undermine the power of social media. And we've seen organizations make that mistake where they think, our public loves us. We're going to be fine here in our city or county. Well, maybe you'll be okay. But if you're talking about a big enough crisis, your problem is national or potentially an international crisis. So while your community may love you, you're going to be hearing from all over the place. And yes, it might be easy to dismiss, hey, we don't care if we're on the West Coast, we don't care what the East Coast says or vice versa. Well, when your phone doesn't stop ringing and when people all across your organization are getting bombarded with emails, with phone calls, when your 911 center is shut down because there are so many incoming calls about your crisis, a lot of that stems from social media. Mm-hmm. And people on there want to hear from organizations. They want them to own the problem. They want the organization to take responsibility for what went wrong. And there's like this wave of people wanting to get what they believe is owed from an organization.
Right.
They're going to get it from them.
Yeah. And absolutely. And I think the other thing that's interesting on the opposite end of the spectrum in terms of maybe not on such a big stage, but there's organizations now when you think about Glassdoor, or you think about Vault, I don't know if Vault is still a thing, I think it is, but where people can go and speak negatively about your organization and create claims there that are false. And so I've dealt with a lot of clients in my world with that because I'm sort of the talent lens or the HR lens of here you have somebody that's left an organization, they're disgruntled, and they're spewing, you know, negative comments about your organization that aren't true. And there's a lot of like, do you, don't you? Should we, you know, you have to do a lot. I think the important thing too is that you spend time thinking about what you want to do strategically. It's whether you decide to or you decide not to comment or whatever that is, have a partner, make sure you reach out to JPC or, you know, someone to make sure that you're evaluating the right things when you're making that decision.
Also, just right now for anyone listening, think about wherever it is that you work. is there a crisis communications plan?
Right.
Has that been discussed? Has leadership thought that through? Who are your messengers going to be? And what is your overall communications philosophy? For us, working with government, we always say lean towards transparency. You're going to be better off from the public standpoint and the media standpoint if the feeling is that you are sharing as much as you can. And you got to aim for the reasonable audience. There's always going to be people, you need to tell me every single thing. Well, that's not going to happen. And reasonable people will understand that. But there's a certain expectation. The public is going to want to know some pretty basic stuff. And if you haven't thought through as an organization, we're either going to be as transparent as possible, or we're going to use these messengers. As you're dealing with the crisis, that's not the time to figure it out.
Yes, for sure. Let's talk a little bit about your transition from being in journalism to being an entrepreneur and being CEO. And you and I joke occasionally we'll have these CEO
chats.
I'll call them riffs. But I think it's really interesting as you've transitioned into this chapter, maybe the question is what surprised you? Like what has surprised you? Because I think in terms of being competent at what you do, being successful at what you do, you think I can go do another thing and that will also be successful because I'm generally somebody that's going to work hard and make it happen. And so what are some of the surprises for you, for other people that are thinking about whether they're in journalism or not, right, to go and kind of do their own thing? What are some of your learnings or surprises that have kind of hit you along the way?
You can do more than you think you can do.
Yeah.
And I dallied with the idea of starting my own business for several years. And of course, there's uncertainty. I actually started to major in business management, and then I had to take pre-calc. So I changed majors to broadcast journalism. I didn't set out to be a business owner. I was a journalist and then law enforcement, media relations, and then this just came to be. So I can't say that the business piece is my favorite part of what I do. I still very much, in some cases, I'm still tweeting for clients or Xing, whatever the heck it's called.
Yeah, yeah.
I am in the weeds in some cases, probably more than I should be because I so love the work. All of the headaches that come along with running a business, I don't know who loves. Maybe there are people that love that.
Right.
We like to do the work. We like to interact with the people, with the clients, and do the actual work. What surprised me, which continues to surprise me, is how fast we're growing. It's like
it's exciting.
The train leaves the station, and all of a sudden you're on an Acela. How did that happen? And so trying to keep up with that and continue to do a good job, maintain your reputation. I could work, 16 hours a day. I could. You got to shut it off at some point. I have kids. I have a husband. I hope to stay married, and I want my kids to love me, and I want to maintain an active social life. And so finding the balance will forever, for my whole life, be my challenge.
Do you think in journalism, and I don't know as much about for you and your role in that, how much of that was dictated by the job in terms of where you had to be and when you had to be there? So if something happened in terms of that 24-hour availability, when you were in that part of your career, was that all the time? Like you were just on call no matter what? Is it there's a shift that you can predict and you know that, okay, well, and they're long shifts. You know, tell me a little bit about that in terms of that, when I think about that balance and where you are now.
As a local reporter, you have a shift. Now that doesn't mean your shift is 8 hours. It doesn't mean that they will keep to that shift. And certainly if there's breaking news, all of that can change. Now, yes, you can be sent away to cover a hurricane, or I covered the Beltway sniper for 3 weeks and all bets are off. But generally speaking, at least when I was there as a local reporter, you have a general idea of when you're going to be working. National correspondence, that's an entirely different ballgame. Back in the day, they lived by pagers. Now they just go all over the country or beyond as they're told to do. And you make a decision as a local reporter, if you get the opportunity to potentially go beyond and go national, you are truly changing the course of your life if you do that, because it really does become all consuming at the national level.
Did you always know you wanted to be in journalism?
No. I started at Loyola College in Baltimore for a year and a half and was like, I don't know what to major in. Okay, business management. I like business. That's cool. And then all those, you know, macroeconomics. Mm-hmm. No, thank you. And so then what I did, I remember walking through Loyola's campus thinking, I'm clearly not good at pre-calc. What am I good at? And it was always writing. And then I said, well, what can you do with a writing career? And somehow I came up with, well, I could probably write a TV story. And I liked the challenge of being able to potentially be on air. And that's when I transferred to the University of Maryland, enrolled in broadcast journalism, took 3 internships over the course of my time there, which I can't recommend enough. You get in there and you really see what it's like, and it'll tell you this is the path you want, or conversely, get the heck out of there. And I loved it. I was hooked.
What do you think for people? Because I think there's a lot of interest in pursuing this type of work. I think there's probably people have a version of what it is and then what it isn't. I think for you, because you lived it, you know, what are some of the things that you feel people should know in terms of pursuing that path? Like one of the things that sticks out for me is like, you have to have a thick skin, I'm guessing, like
so thick,
like just the on air piece, but also you and I have talked a little bit about the environment is pretty cutthroat. And we joke about the soft skills. You're like, well, I was hard news, so there's not a lot of soft skills. So I was like, oh, maybe they should be clients. But the idea of the harshness of it. So I'm curious, like, how do you, I don't know. Tell me a little bit about the environment and what, you know, people should expect if they want to pursue it.
It's absolutely stressful. There's no question about it. It's perfect for an adrenaline junkie.
Yeah.
Because there is that rush with the potential for breaking news. There's that rush/fear. How am I going to pull this off and get it done in time and be presentable and be in control? And then there are the moments that I still remember where you'll knock on a door because it's your job to cover that fatal crash where a teenager has tragically been killed. And your job is to tell the story for that local community about that crash. That is a responsibility that most journalists don't want. And you've got to knock on that door and ask whoever answers, can I talk to you about this most horrible day in their lives? And the responses range from get off my property to please come in. Can I make you a cup of coffee? I want to tell you about my daughter. And it's moments like that, that to this day, stick with me. People do. There's something cathartic for some about talking about their loved one. And so the notion of you terrible media, you shouldn't be doing that. I understand that concept, but it's also in some cases healing for people to do that.
And I think it's interesting as you're talking, I just had a conversation yesterday with someone about, I think this is easier to do as you age. The idea of what you do and rooting it in the service it's providing. So I think all of us, regardless of the role that you play or the job that you have, if you anchor, like for you, in terms of being a journalist in that moment, you're your vessel to tell a story. And I think when you come from that space, you're able to handle more of the stress, the adrenaline, the rejection. I think it's when you start to be more, if it's about you as a person or it becomes more ego-driven, that's when I think it's even harder to sustain it or be good at it. And I'm curious if you, what you think about that.
There's plenty of egos in journalism.
Yeah.
I don't think that's a surprise, but absolutely that career, that storytelling, that story gathering, that's why so many journalists go into PR, because you nurture that storytelling skill and it translates perfectly. To this day, when I have conversations with friends or relatives, they're like, you're still a reporter. It's like, I want to know so much about whatever the topic is. I love that you do podcasts just for the love of it, to hear people's stories. And that is it's just sort of ingrained in you. I don't know if that's answering the question.
No, I think it does. And then how about the rejection side of it? How do you deal with that? How do you deal with being exposed from a over and over again. I mean, I feel like it's a tough industry from that perspective.
You are rejected constantly as a journalist. You try this, you get told no, and you go in another direction and you try that. And that has served me well. I don't know if I had thick skin going in. I grew up in New York, so maybe. And or does the profession just give you that thick skin, and does it weed out the people who don't? Because it's hard. It's just it's a stressful career, and even more so now. But it was a great transition to move into a place where I had to create cultural change, and where there was resistance to the notion of why would we be telling our stories, mm-hmm. as you say, Julie. We're a police department. That's not, we hold investigations and other things close to the vest. We're not the media. And that's not the point. The point is that we need to be better communicators about not only this department, but for the profession in general, and to educate the public about the work that you do.
Teresa's new book, Soft Skills I Learned the Hard Way, is out and available on Amazon. She writes about many epic fails throughout her career and how she learned from them so you don't have to. This book is full of cheat codes for how you can differentiate yourself when it matters, like in interviews, trying to get a promotion, or being a first-time leader. As always, thank you, Relatable Community. We are so grateful for your support and continued listenership. As of today, we are 8,000 listeners and 15 countries strong. Now back to the show.
And it's interesting that I think the thread that pulls through as you're talking about it is that what you're discussing, I mean, in terms of a transformation of taking an industry, if you think about law enforcement, and really transforming it to act and operate a little bit differently in this capacity. And that's a big challenge. Yep. Like that's like a big thing to chew on or to try to change or move. And so the idea that, like, you know, you're not maybe in that newsroom environment, but you're still in an environment that is challenging and difficult, and you have to maneuver, I think, in order to make an impact or to change.
You need to maneuver in some cases more delicately than I did. I kind of came in like a bull into the china shop, and I could have used your soft skills training, because I just want, like, I believe so firmly in what it is that we do, that I had to appreciate not everyone is there yet. I believe that they would get there. And I think as a whole, I know as a whole, you see law enforcement changing the way that they communicate with the public, mm-hmm. more so than ever. And the public in part demanded that. I like the notion of cultural change, because I knew that this was the right thing. And I do like the idea of a challenge. And you're not going to win everybody over. You need to have thick skin to know that. And you need the support at the top, who also believes in the mission.
That was actually my next question, because I feel like this is one of the areas that I love to talk to people about. And I think in the work that you do in particular, the idea of influence, and how are you influencing people to, even if it's in their best interest, like your job right now is to influence people to take action in a particular way. And it's a tough crowd,
yeah,
that already has an adversarial relationship with what it is that you're trying to change and educate. So as you've evolved and as you've moved into this space, how have you changed your approach to influence? I mean, maybe you just talked about it a little bit, but I'm curious, is there any other tips or anything else you've learned?
Show results.
I love that.
We try to get the departments to be more communicative, here's an example. We posted XYZ. Here's how the public is responding to this. They are singing your praises. They are thanking you. There's suddenly this very tangible result of the change that we are requesting of you. Mm-hmm. And it's that piece. We would send it out department wide. Hey, look at this post. We wanted you to see all the support that's out there for you, because it's very easy to hear the noise and the loud detractors. But then there's something about seeing that everyone wants a pat on the back. Everybody. Yeah. I don't care if they say they don't.
Yes.
Everybody wants it. And it's nice to be validated every now and then. So showing results is critical. Here's your proof.
What about actually in your, I just thought of this as you're talking, what about when there isn't crisis, but some positive messaging around good things that are happening? One of the things that, as I hear you talking and I think about this community of people, there's, you only hear about it when there's bad things happening, and there's so much good that happens. There's so many people that have dedicated their life to service. And so it sounds maybe kitschy, but the idea of some positive promotion or just a reflection of what is really going on, that's great.
Every organization before the crisis hits needs to be basically in preparation mode. How do you get in prep mode before the crisis hits? You communicate with the public who you are.
Like regularly.
What you do, yeah. Regularly. Here's our good news. Here's our neutral news. So that when the thing goes boom, mm-hmm. people feel as if they know you to a certain extent. They've heard from you. They trust you. You've developed this rapport either because you're out there in the public speaking, or they see you online, on social media. They get a sense of who you are. If you're crickets, just quiet, and then the crisis happens, are you going to get the benefit of the doubt? Potentially not. So we always talk about telling your good news. Here's another challenge that I faced in the beginning. And it's noteworthy, and it's true that generally speaking, many police officers' mindset is, it's no big deal. I just pulled $50 out of my wallet to help this young mother who needed help. It's no big deal. I dropped what I was doing on Christmas morning to help this family in need. It's no big deal. And we work really hard to encourage government across the board that it is a big deal, that you need to share those kinds of stories in a not so much braggadocious way, but in a, again, going back to the notion of telling a story, you've got to think critically about how you communicate the good things that you're doing. So it's not just, hey, pay attention to me. Hey, I need a pat on the back, but this is who we are. This is one example of who we are as an organization.
And I also think I think it's a proven philosophy, so I don't know the actual technical name for it, but it is true that if you and I have 100 positive interactions, which we've had,
yes,
and then you F up or something happens,
not that that would happen,
never,
right?
Not even a big thing, but something happens that is a negative experience that we have, because we had 100 positive, I'm going to give you the benefit of the doubt.
Exactly.
This operates when you think of any work relationship you have. So you put this in the context of work or organizations, the idea of, you know, we talk about people that want to get promoted or people that are trying to have someone on their team get promoted, or you can take this into like very real application of, or you yourself are trying to get an interesting assignment, or you're trying to manage a crisis, like whatever the thing is. If you have goodwill, if you've built up, mm-hmm. I call them the chips, if you build up these chips, I am much more apt to say that was a bad day for Julie and not even consider it because we had so many right. good experiences. So it ties to what you're saying, I think, with respect to that transparency. And I get, because I bristle too at the idea, we talk like the whole self-promotion thing and people feeling like this is just false or it's not genuine. Like the real work that we do as a police community is A, B, and C. And this, it feels disingenuous. And I think there's a line there between like that versus like, hey, there's a whole state of things that you're doing that people should know about because it's good stuff.
We refer to it as the goodwill bank.
Help people feel good.
The goodwill bank.
Yes.
You gotta put in those deposits into the goodwill bank. Because at some point, you're going to need the public's benefit of the doubt. Everything yes. you just said is spot on.
Yes. And I would just take that too, like whether you're in law enforcement or in any job that you're in. Like that's why relationships are so important. This idea of like, I'm here for you and I'm going to deliver for you. And that just translates to so many great things. Let's just talk about for you, one of the questions I love to ask people, and it's morphed over the years that I've done this, but I find that most people have had what I call kind of, you were teasing me the other day, this sort of shape-shifting moment, and it doesn't have to be that dramatic. But I think there are moments in people's lives that are sort of pivots, where they've had something, an intersection point. And the reason I like to ask about this question, or the reason I ask this question, is I do think that people that are listening, everybody's been at these points in their life where they're at a crossroads and they're not quite sure what to do. So what I like to dig into a little bit is, what is one of those moments for you, and then what helped? And so it could be as a young person, you know, when you were in high school or college, or maybe it was mid-career or more recently, but, or maybe it was a certain mentor that showed you something that it was like, oh, it's kind of light bulb moment. What's something that sticks out for you in your path so far?
I would say it's probably either making the leap from journalism into media relations, or leaving that media relations world and starting the business. And I'll focus on the latter, mm-hmm. because the guidance that I've been giving my daughters, who are now 20 and 16, is you need to trust your gut. And as a teenager or early in my 20s, I didn't, for whatever reason, immaturity, insecurity, whatever. I just didn't trust my gut. And the older you get and the more success you've had, the more you trust your gut. And had I not listened to that voice saying, of course there were questions about whether I could make the leap and start a business and start a successful business. Of course there are questions. But I had to trust in the fact that my whole career up until this point, I'd been working very hard. I'd been building relationships, and I'd been devoted essentially to this new profession of law enforcement, of trying to change the way that the profession communicated with the public. And so had I not been confident enough to trust my gut, I would have just stayed working in organizations and working for other people. And not that there's anything wrong with that, but now I have this baby of mine that's very quickly becoming a toddler and then an elementary school and all. I feel like I'm going to have a high schooler any second. And how exciting is that to be able to watch this thing grow and build? And it's doing something. Like, I feel like we have people across the country who are subject matter experts, literally making a difference as they teach these classes, as they sit down with clients and help steer them through what is very much a very stressful moment in time for them.
What do you think helped you make the jump in terms of that confidence and the trust in your gut? What was in place for you? And I think for each person, this list is very different. So for you, what was in place that you said, okay, I can do this. I'm willing to take the risk.
Being surrounded by smart people who I trusted, who I called upon, what do you think? Mm-hmm. And respecting their decisions. And even if I didn't necessarily totally believe that this was going to be a thing that would work, hearing them say with conviction, there's no question you can do this. Had I not been surrounded by great people, I don't know that I would have done it on my own.
It's so interesting. I just interviewed a really good friend of mine that I've known forever, but I talked to her more specifically about her role. She's a registered dietitian. And she had people along her path telling her not, like, she wasn't going to be able to do it.
Oh.
And it like broke my heart. And she did it despite that.
I love that.
But I was like, gosh, you know, here's someone that's trying and is found something that she loves to do. And they're like, yeah, I don't. Even in high school, someone told her, yeah, I don't even think you should try to go to college.
Wow.
And like she, and so to hear you say that you had people, I do think it's underrated. Like you the cheerleader, or if you are someone that is approached by a friend, you know, be a cheerleader or help them to see what the potential is. And the other thing that I loved about what you said, which I think is so true and has proven true for me, is when you are in the, before starting your own business and you are delivering on your own, you can't see what could be.
No.
Like you can have a vision and you know that what you're doing makes an impact, but you're also betting on the unseen. And that's the scary part. And that's maybe, to me, that's the a little bit of the adrenaline part. If you are an adrenaline person, you're like, it's not even so much like I'm going to bet on myself, which you are, but you're like, I'm going to bet on the unseen because who knows what that could be. And if this is, to your point, like this transformation that's happening and you are having big impact, like that's amazing. And so it kind of trips on itself. Like once you make the leap, then these other things fall into place. So it's super exciting.
I'm still an adrenaline junkie.
Yeah.
So chasing after a piece of business, I want that. I'm going to win. There's adrenaline there. I'm leaving you to drive to DC to do a presentation. I haven't looked at the thing that I'm about to present. And I like that because it makes me like on edge. And I generally know what's coming next, but I don't really know what's coming next. And even just timing a presentation, I finished one yesterday in Ocean City and I didn't have a clock in front of me and it was a 2-hour presentation. And I finish with 5 minutes to go for Q&A. That's fun to me.
That is awesome. That's the whole like symphony aspect of it where that's that preparedness. If you hadn't had, this is the other thing I think is so important to tell people. If you haven't had 25 years of you learning and preparing.
Sets and reps.
Absolutely. Like you're not going to be able to do what you just described. And I think in terms of some of our junior talent that's growing, that's such an important thing to remember that, you know, the practice and the reps are what get you to this stage where it's much more comfortable. You can think on your feet, you're on the fly, those kind of things. Okay. Tell me about young Julie and you're like with her at about 25, you put your arm around her and you're going to give her some counsel and advice that would help to make the path to this point just a little bit easier. I'm not someone that's like, everything happens for a reason. I'm not trying to change the course of your life. But I do think there's things we would say to a younger version of ourselves that could have made it a little easier. Yeah. What would you tell her?
I did not love my 20s. And I think in part it's because I wasn't fully ripened yet. I was still doubting myself and I still had insecurities and I hated feeling insecure. I hated it. And so I felt like I was sort of uncomfortable in that decade. And then something happened when you hit 30, and it's not like that day magically it happened, but there's something about that transition. And suddenly the confidence started coming and I felt so much more at ease. I liked myself better. And the reason why I keep saying to my daughters, trust your gut, is you're better than you think you are. And listen to the people around you who are telling you, you're smart, you're genuine, you're funny, you can do this, you're creative. Listen to those people. Don't brush it off and say, yeah, 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 and not really feel it. Listen to people. And had I been more confident in my 20s, I think I'd be even farther along than I am now. But there's just that, for me personally, I was just still insecure.
And I think that insecurity of potentially having other people define what you are versus you being able to define that, right? Like in terms of like, you know who you are deep down in there, but then you have all this stimuli coming at you, maybe challenging that or telling you you're something different.
You've got to, I think that one of the reasons I didn't love my 20s is it's almost like everything's a new job. You don't know the people, you don't know the place, you don't know the rules. There's a whole bunch of stuff you don't know.
Yes.
So of course you're not super confident, but the more you do it and the more you accomplish, I think I would tell my 25-year-old self, look at that. I was a producer in San Diego for the Republican National Convention as part of C-SPAN. At the time, I was like, oh, I just went off to San Diego and we did this thing and it was good. And I was like, no, take a moment. That's a big deal. Take a moment to acknowledge what you've accomplished and don't just put your head down and dive into the next thing. Realize what you've done. Appreciate your own successes and realize you are starting to make that. You're starting to stack up your successes.
I love that. It's the absorbing that because we are all so focused on the constructive negative part of an experience. I don't know what it is about humans. There's probably some psychological tendency, but the idea that like, to your point of like, this is a big deal. You can be proud of yourself. You can give yourself I think there's something about ego and coming across like you use the word braggadocious. Like if I feel good about this and I let myself feel that, then there's something that's braggy about it or it's ego. And I think it's the opposite.
Yeah. And as you say that, I'm like, no, you just did something really good. You've got this podcast. You wrote a book. You're teaching clients. You have so many successes. And maybe just surround yourself with people who love on you a lot.
Right. Exactly.
Maybe it's that.
For sure.
Maybe it's
for
that.
Sure. Okay. Now let's talk soft skills now that I've educated you.
Oh, gosh. Can I leave now?
Now that you've been with me for 6 months, 8 months. I don't know how long it's been. But like what maybe for you, because it's been a newer territory, what have you learned about soft skills that you think is made an impact for you after spending some time with me and kind of hearing about my version of why they're so important and the impact that they have? I mean, you might have a favorite one now, but I'm interested in how that's evolved for you.
Being softer.
Yeah.
That don't run into something like the bull in the china shop. Think about how you are perceived by other people. Know that if you're an adrenaline junkie and you're aggressive, well, not everyone is. And how is that going to come across to them? And if you're a fast mover, slow down. It's really hard to do, but the faster I go, the less communicative I am or the more confusing I am. So I need to focus on taking a beat and being more thoughtful about who is receiving my message and how they need to take in information.
I love it. And I would challenge people to, if that's your end, and then the person on the other side has a responsibility to share it with you if it's not happening. And I think that's where growth and how people learn, and it's hard.
It is.
It's hard. If you can find people in your life that will be that person for you. I mean, I've hired you to be that person for me because I think it's really hard to see yourself objectively.
It is.
So the idea of, I need you to mirror back to me what is being put into the world so that I can reflect what I want to reflect. And so the same thing on the soft skills side, if you're someone that is more of a hard charger and you move fast and you have a lot of adrenaline, this idea of like, do you have a friend in the room that's going to be like, Julie?
Slow your roll.
Right? Because that helps, I think, with the whole soft skills space, like having that partner or having a trusted resource. Or I'll ask Hannah all the time after something, like, how did that go? What do you think? What could have gone to get better? So it's just, I don't know, you being open is half the battle, but then also having people around you that will share it too.
My vice president, it's the balance between us is hilarious because yes. I'm like, go, 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 and emotional and all. And he is just as calm as can be and reasonable and rational. And if something occurs where I want to fire off an email, I'll send it to him. And he's like, maybe we go this route. And I'll listen because I respect and trust him. And people like you, you're coachable. And not everyone is. Not everyone wants to hear.
I know.
Even constructive criticism. And so I appreciate you for that.
Well, thank you for doing this.
Thank
I
you
hope
so
you enjoyed
much.
It. You're
I
great.
Loved it.
I know. I
thank
can talk
you.
To you forever.
Thank you so much, Julie, for joining us and for sharing all of your great advice. I loved what you said around storytelling as a powerful tool, especially with respect to cultural change and the importance of embracing rejection. And as we think about your comments today, let's consider how we might be able to be softer in our approach and take a moment to consider how you're perceived by others. And never underestimate the impact of soft skills. Thank you to Missy for producing this episode and Hannah for your support. A big thank you to our relatable community. If you enjoyed this conversation, please take a moment and subscribe and rate us on your favorite streaming platform. Relatable is sponsored by TFA Soft Skills, and you can find more information about Relatable and our sponsor by visiting tfasoftskills.com. Until next time, this is Teresa Freeman with Relatable. Stay connected.